This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Light We Lost. This is the author, Jill Santopolo. For New York City. Prologue. We've known each other for almost half our lives. I've seen you smiling, confident, blissfully happy. I've seen you broken, wounded, lost. But I've never seen you like this. You taught me to look for beauty. In darkness, in destruction, you always found light. I don't know what beauty I'll find here, what light. But I'll try. I'll do it for you because I know you would do it for me. There was so much beauty in our life together. Maybe that's where I should start. 1. Sometimes objects seem like they've witnessed history. I used to imagine that the wooden table we sat around during Kramer's Shakespeare seminar our senior year was as old as Columbia. That it had been in that room since 1754, edges worn smooth by centuries of students like us, which of course couldn't be true. But that's how I pictured it. Students sitting there through the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, both World Wars, Korea, Vietnam, the Persian Gulf. It's funny. If you asked me who else was with us that day, I don't think I could tell you. I used to be able to see all their faces so clearly. But 13 years later, I remember only you and Professor Kramer. I can't even recall the name of the TA who came running late into the classroom. Later even than you. Kramer had just finished calling roll when you pushed open the door. He smiled at me, your dimple making a brief appearance as you slipped off your Diamondback's cap and stuck it into your back pocket. Your eyes landed quickly on the empty seat next to mine, and then you did, too.
And you are?
Kramer asked as you reached into your backpack for a notebook and a pen. Gabe, you said. Gabriel Sampson. Kramer checked the paper in front of him.
Let's aim for on time for the rest of the semester, Mr. Sampson, he said. Class starts at 9. In fact, let's aim for early.
You nodded and Kramer started talking about themes in Julius Caesar.
We at the height are ready to decline, he read. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. Amidded all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea we are now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures. I trust you all did the reading. Who can tell me what Brutus is saying about fate and free will here?
I'll always remember that passage because I've wondered so many times since that day whether you and I were fated to meet in Kramer's Shakespeare seminar, whether it's destiny or decision that has kept us connected all these years, or a combination of both, taking the current when it serves. After Kramer spoke, a few people flipped through the text in front of them. You ran your fingers through your curls, and they sprang back into place. Well, you said, and the rest of the class joined me in looking at you. But you didn't get to finish. The TA, whose name I can't remember, came racing into the room. Sorry I'm late, she said. A plane hit one of the Twin Towers. It came on TV just as I was leaving for class. No one knew the significance of her words. Not even she did.
Was the pilot drunk? Kramer asked.
I don't know, the TA said, taking a seat at the table. I waited, but the newscasters had no idea what was going on. They said it was some kind of prop plane. If it had happened now, all of our phones would have been blowing up with news. Pings from Twitter and Facebook and push notifications from the New York Times. But communication then wasn't yet instant, and Shakespeare wouldn't be interrupted. We all shrugged it off, and Kramer kept talking about Caesar. As I took notes, I watched the fingers of your right hand unconsciously rub against the wood grain of the table. I doodled an image of your thumb with its ragged nail and torn cuticle. I still have the notebook somewhere, in a box filled with lit hum and contemporary civilizations. I'm sure it's there. 2. I'll never forget what we said when we left Philosophy Hall. Even though the words were nothing special, the conversation is burned into my memory as part of that day. We started down the steps together. Not exactly together, but next to each other. The air was clear, the sky was blue, and everything had changed. We just didn't know it yet. People all around us were talking over one another. The Twin Towers collapsed. School's canceled. I want to donate blood. Do you know where I can donate blood? I turned to you. What's going on? I live in East Campus, you said, pointing toward the dorm. Let's go find out. You're Lucy, right? Where do you live? Hogan, I said. And yeah, Lucy. Nice to meet you, Lucy. I'm Gabriel. You held out your hand. Amid everything, I shook it and looked up at you as I did. Your dimple came back. Your eyes shone blue. I thought then for the first time, he's beautiful. We went to your suite and watched TV with your roommates, with Adam and Scott and Justin. On the screen, bodies dove out of buildings. Blackened mounds of rubble sent smoke signals into the sky, and the towers fell in a loop. The devastation numbed us. We stared at the images, unable to reconcile the stories with our reality. The fact that this was happening in our city, 7 miles from where we sat, that those were people, actual human beings, hadn't set in yet. At least not for me. It felt so far away. Our cell phones didn't work. You used your dorm phone to call your mom in Arizona to tell her you were fine. I called my parents in Connecticut who wanted me to come home. They knew someone whose daughter worked at the World Trade Center and no one had heard from her yet. Someone else whose cousin had a breakfast meeting at Windows on the World. It's safer outside Manhattan, my father said. What if there's anthrax or some other biological warfare, nerve gas? I told my dad the subways weren't running, probably not the trains either. I'll come get you, he said. I'll jump in the car now. I'll be okay, I told him. I'm with some friends. We're fine. I'll call you again later. It still didn't feel real. You know, Scott said after I hung up, if I were a terrorist organization, I'd drop a bomb on us. What the fuck, Adam said. He was waiting to hear from his uncle who was part of the NYPD. I mean, if you think about it academically, Scott said, but he didn't get any further. Shut up, Justin said. Seriously, Scott, not the time. Maybe I should leave, I said to you then. I didn't really know you. I had just met your friends. My roommates are probably wondering where I am. Call them, you said, handing the phone back to me. And tell them you're going to the roof of the Ween dorm. Tell them they can meet you there if you want. I'm going where? With me, you said, and you ran your fingers absently along my braid. It was an intimate gesture, the kind of thing that happens after all barriers of personal space have been breached, like eating off someone else's plate without asking. And all of a sudden, I felt connected to you, like your hand on my hair meant something more than idle, nervous fingers. I thought of that moment years later when I decided to donate my hair and the stylist handed me my braid, wrapped in plastic, looking even darker brown than usual. Even though you were a world away then, I felt like I was betraying you, like I was cutting our tie. But then, that day, right after you touched my hair, you realized what you'd done and you let your hand drop into your lap. You smiled at me again, but it didn't go to your eyes this time. I shrugged. Okay, I said. The world felt like it was cracking in pieces, like we'd gone through a shattered mirror into the fractured place inside, where nothing made sense, where our shields were down, our walls broken. In that place, there wasn't any reason to say no. 3. We took the elevator up to Ween 11, and then you pulled open a window at the end of the hallway. Someone showed me this sophomore year, you said. It's the most incredible view of New York City you'll ever see. We climbed out the window onto the roof, and I gasped. Smoke billowed up from the southern tip of Manhattan. The whole sky was turning gray, the city shrouded in ash. Oh my God, I said. Tears filled my eyes. I pictured what used to be there. Saw the negative space where the towers had stood. It finally hit me. There were people in those buildings. Your hand found mine and held it. We stood there staring at the aftermath of destruction, tears dripping down both our cheeks. For how long, I don't know. There must have been other people up there with us, but I can't recall them. Just you. And the image of that smoke, it seared into my brain. What happens now? I finally whispered. Seeing it made me understand the magnitude of the attack. What's next? You looked at me, and our eyes, still wet with tears, locked with the kind of magnetism that ignores the world around it. Your hand slid to my waist, and I rose up onto my toes to meet your lips halfway. We pressed our bodies together, as if that would protect us from whatever came after. As if the only way to stay safe was to keep my lips on yours. The moment your body enveloped mine, that's how I felt. Safe, enfolded in the strength and warmth of your arms. Your muscles fluttered against my hands and I buried my fingers in your hair. You wrapped my braid around your palm, tugging it and tipping my head back. And I forgot the world. In that moment, there was only you. For years I felt guilty about it. Guilty that we kissed for the first time while the city burned. Guilty that I was able to lose myself in you in that moment. But later I learned that we weren't alone. People told me in whispers that they'd had sex that day, they'd conceived a child, they'd gotten engaged, said I love you for the first time. There's something about death that makes people want to live. We wanted to live that day. And I don't blame us for it. Not anymore. When we broke for breath, I leaned my head against your chest. I listened to your heart and was comforted by its steady beating. Did my heartbeat comfort you? Does it still? 4. We went back to your dorm room because you promised me lunch. You wanted to go onto the roof with your camera after we ate, you told me, and take some pictures. For the Spectator? I asked. The paper, you said? Nah, for me. In the kitchen, I got distracted by a stack of your photos. Black and white prints taken all over campus. They were beautiful, bizarre, bathed in light. Images zoomed so far in that an everyday object looked like modern art. Where's this one? I asked. After looking for a while, I realized it was a close-up of a bird's nest, lined with what looked like newspapers and magazines and someone's essay for a French literature class. Oh, that was incredible, you told me. Jessica Cho, do you know her? She sings a cappella, David Blum's girlfriend. She told me about this nest that she could see out her window that someone's homework got worked into. So I went to check it out. I had to hang out the window to get the shot. Jess made Dave hold my ankles because she was afraid I would fall, but I got it. After that story, I saw you differently. You were daring, brave, committed to capturing art. Looking back, I'm guessing that's what you wanted me to think. You were trying to impress me, but I didn't realize it at the time. I just thought, wow. I thought, he's wonderful. But what was true then, and has been true as long as I've known you, is that you find beauty everywhere. You notice things other people don't. It's something I've always admired about you. Is this what you want to do? I asked then, indicating the pictures. You shook your head. It's just for fun, you said. My mom's an artist. You should see what she can do, these gorgeous, enormous abstracts. But she makes a living by painting small canvases of Arizona sunsets for tourists. I don't want that kind of life, creating what sells. I leaned against the counter and looked at the rest of the photographs. Rust leaching into a stone bench, cracked veins of marble, corrosion on a metal railing. Beauty where I'd never imagined it could be. Is your dad an artist too? I asked. Your face closed. I could see it, like a door shutting behind your eyes. No, you said. He's not. I had stumbled into a fault line I didn't know was there. I filed that away. I was discovering the landscape of you. Already, I was hoping it was terrain I'd learn well, one that would become second nature to navigate. You were quiet. I was quiet. The TV was still blaring in the background, and I heard the newscasters talking about the Pentagon and the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. The horror of the situation rushed over me again. I put your photographs down. It seemed perverse to focus on beauty then, but looking back, maybe that was exactly the right thing to do. Didn't you say we were going to eat lunch, I asked? Even though I wasn't hungry, even though the images flashing across the television screen made my stomach churn. The door opened behind your eyes. That I did, you said, with a nod. All you had the ingredients for were nachos, so mechanically,
I sliced tomatoes and opened a can of beans with a rusty can opener, while you arranged tortilla chips in one of those throwaway foil trays and grated cheese into a chipped cereal bowl. "What about you?" you asked, as if our conversation hadn't gotten derailed. "Hmm?" I pressed the top of the can into the beans so I could lever it off. "Are you an artist?" I put the metal disc down on the counter. "Nope," I said. "The most creative thing I do is write stories for my roommates." "About what?" you asked, your head cocked to one side. I looked down so you wouldn't see me blush. "This is embarrassing," I said, "but they're about a teacup pig named Hamilton who accidentally got accepted into a college meant for rabbits." You let out a surprised laugh. "Hamilton, a pig," you said. "I get it, that's funny." "Thanks," I said, looking up at you again. "So is that what you want to do after graduation?" You had reached for the jar of salsa and were tapping its lid against the countertop to loosen it. I shook my head. "I don't think there's a big market out there for Hamilton the Pig stories. I've been thinking about going into advertising, but saying it now, it sounds silly." "Why silly?" you asked, twisting the lid off with a pop. I looked over at the TV. "Does it mean anything, advertising? If this were my last day on Earth and I'd spent my whole adult life coming up with campaigns to sell people shredded cheese or nacho chips, would I feel like my time here was well spent?" You bit your lip. Your eyes said, "I'm thinking about this." I learned more of your topography. Perhaps you learned a bit of mine. "What makes a life well spent?" you asked. "That's what I'm trying to figure out," I told you, my mind turning as I was talking. "I think it might have something to do with making a mark in a positive way, leaving the world a little bit better than it was when you found it. I still believe that, Gabe. It's what I've been striving my whole life to do. I think you have too." I saw something blossom in your face then. I wasn't sure what it meant. I hadn't learned you well enough yet. But now I know that look. It means perspectives are shifting in your mind. You dipped a chip in the salsa and held it out to me. "Bite?" you asked. I crunched it in half and you popped the rest into your mouth. Your eyes traced the planes of my face and traveled down the length of my body. I could feel you examining me from different angles and vantage points. Then you brushed my cheek with your fingertips and we kissed again. This time you tasted like salt and chili pepper. When I was 5 or 6, I drew on my bedroom wall with a red crayon. I don't think I ever told you the story. Anyway, as I was drawing hearts and trees and suns and moons and clouds, I knew I was doing something I shouldn't. I could feel it in the pit of my stomach, but I couldn't stop myself. I wanted to do it so badly. My room had been decorated in pink and yellow, but my favorite color was red. And I wanted my room to be red. I needed my room to be red. Drawing on the wall felt completely right and absolutely wrong at the same time. That's how I felt the day I met you. Kissing you in the middle of tragedy and death felt completely right and absolutely wrong at the same time. But I concentrated on the part that felt right, the way I always do. I slid my hand into the back pocket of your jeans, and you slid your hand into mine. We pulled each other closer. The phone in your room rang, but you ignored it. Then the phone in Scott's room rang. A few seconds later, Scott came into the kitchen and cleared his throat. We broke apart and faced him. "Stephanie's looking for you, Gabe," he said. "I put her on hold." "Stephanie?" I asked. "No one," you answered, just as Scott said. "His ex! She's crying, dude," Scott told you. You looked torn, your eyes going from Scott to me and back again. "Would you tell her I'll call her back in a few minutes?" you said to him. Scott nodded and left, and then you grabbed my hand, weaving your fingers through mine. Our eyes met like they had on the roof, and I couldn't look away. My heart sped up. "Lucy?" you said, somehow infusing my name with desire. "I know you're here, and I know that makes this strange, but I should see if she's okay. We were together all last school year and only broke up last month. This day, I get it," I said. And weirdly, it made me like you better, that while you weren't dating Stephanie anymore, you still cared about her. I should head back to my roommates anyway, I said, even though I didn't want to go. Thank you for... I started the sentence without knowing how to end it, and then found I couldn't. You squeezed my fingers. Thank you for making this day about something more, you said. Lucy. Luce. Luce is light in Spanish, right? You paused. I nodded. Well, thank you for filling a dark day with light. You'd put into words the feeling I couldn't express. You did the same for me, I said. Thank you. We kissed again, and it was hard to tear myself away from you. It was so hard to leave. I'll call you later, you said. I'll find you in the directory. I'm sorry about the nachos. Stay safe, I said. We can always eat nachos another time. That sounds good, you answered. And I left, wondering if it was possible for one of the most horrific days I'd ever experienced to somehow contain a small nugget of goodness. You did call me a few hours later, but it wasn't the conversation I'd expected. You said you were sorry, so sorry, but you and Stephanie had gotten back together. Her eldest brother was missing. He worked at One World Trade, and she needed you. You said you hoped I understood, and you thanked me again for bringing light to such a horrible afternoon. You said it meant a lot to have me there. And you apologized once more. I shouldn't have been crushed, but I was. I didn't speak to you for the rest of fall semester, or spring semester either. I changed my seat in Kramer's class so I wouldn't have to sit next to you. But I listened every time you spoke about the way you saw beauty in Shakespeare's language and imagery, even in the ugliest scenes. Alas, you read aloud, a crimson river of warm blood, like to a bubbling fountain stirred with wind, doth rise and fall between thy rose lips. All I could think about was your lips and how they felt pressed against mine. I tried to forget that day, but it was impossible. I couldn't forget what happened to New York, to America, to the people in the towers. And I couldn't forget what happened between us. Even now, whenever anyone asks, were you in New York when the towers fell? Or, where were you that day? Or, what was it like here? The first thing I think of is you. There are moments that shift the trajectory of people's lives. For so many of us who lived in New York City then, September 11th was that moment. Anything I did that day would have been important, would have been burned into my mind and branded on my heart. I don't know why I met you that day, but I do know that because I did, you would have been a part of my personal history forever. 5. It was May and we'd just graduated. We'd handed back our caps and gowns, trading them for diplomas written in Latin, emblazoned with our names, first, middle, and last. I walked into Le Monde with my family, my mother, my father, my brother Jason, two grandparents, and an uncle. They seated us next to another family, a much smaller family, yours. You looked up as we filed by and you reached out, touching my arm. Lucy, you said, congratulations. I shivered. All those months later, feeling your skin against mine did that to me. But I still managed to say, you too. What are you up to, you asked. Are you staying in the city? I nodded. I got a job working in program development at a new TV production company. Kids shows. I couldn't help grinning. It was a job I'd been crossing my fingers over for almost 2 months before I got it. The kind of job that I'd started thinking about soon after the towers fell. After I admitted that I wanted to do something more meaningful than advertising. A job that could reach the next generation and had the potential to change the future. Kid shows, you said. A smile played across your lips. Like Alvin and the Chipmunks? Will they have helium voices? Not quite, I said, laughing a little, wanting to tell you that it was our conversation that led me there. That the moment we shared in your kitchen meant so much. How about you? McKinsey, you said. Consulting. No chipmunks for me. I was surprised. I hadn't expected that, after our talk, after hearing your analyses in Kramer's class. But what I said was, that's great. Congratulations on the job. Maybe I'll see you around the city sometime. That would be nice, you answered. And I went to sit down at the table with my family. Who was that? I heard someone ask. I looked up. There was a girl next to you with long, wheat-colored hair, almost to the middle of her back, and her hand on your thigh. She'd barely registered I was so focused on you. "Just a girl I know from class, Stephanie," I heard you say, which, of course, was all I was. But somehow it stung. 6. New York is a funny city. You can live there for years and never see your next-door neighbor. And then you can run into your best friend while getting into a subway car on your way to work. Fate versus free will. Maybe it's both. It was March, almost a year after graduation, and New York City had swallowed us up. I was living with Kate on the Upper East Side in that huge apartment that had once belonged to her grandparents. It was something she and I had talked about doing ever since we were in middle school. Our childhood dreams had become a reality. I'd had a 6-month fling with a coworker, a couple of one-night stands, and a handful of dates with men I deemed not smart enough or not handsome enough or not exciting enough. Though, in hindsight, there probably wasn't much wrong with them at all. Actually, if I'd met Darren then, I might have thought the same thing about him. Without the constant reminder of Philosophy Hall or the East Campus dorms, I'd stop thinking about you, mostly. We hadn't seen each other in close to a year. But you did pop into my mind at work when I was skimming storyboards with my boss when we were reviewing episodes focused on acceptance and respect. I thought about your kitchen and felt good about the decision I made. Before long, it was Thursday, March 20th, and I was turning 23. I had a party planned for the weekend, but my two closest friends at work, writer's room Alexis and art department Julia, as you called them later, insisted that we have a drink on my birthday. The three of us had become obsessed with faces and names that winter because of the fireplace and the couches. The temperature was hovering around 40, but we thought the bar might turn the fireplace on if we asked. We'd been there enough during the past few months, and the bartender liked us. Julia had made me a paper birthday crown that she insisted I wear, and Alexis ordered all of us apple martinis. We sat on the couch in front of the fire, coming up with things to toast before each sip. "To birthdays," Alexis started. "To Lucy," Julia said. "To friends," I added. Which devolved into, "To the photocopy machine not jamming today," and "To bosses who call in sick," and "To free lunches scrounged after fancy meetings," and "To bars with fireplaces," and "To apple martinis." The waitress came over to our couch with a tray that had 3 more martinis on it. "Oh, we didn't order those," Julia said. The waitress smiled. "You girls have a secret admirer." She nodded toward the bar. There you were. For a moment, I thought I was hallucinating. You gave us a small wave. "He said to say happy birthday to Lucy." Alexis's jaw dropped. "You know him?" she said. "He's hot." Then she picked up one of the new martinis that the waitress had placed on the table in front of us. "To cute boys in bars who know your name and send over free drinks," she toasted. After we all took a sip, she added, "Go thank him, birthday girl." I put the martini down, but changed my mind, taking it with me as I walked toward you, wobbling only slightly on my high heels. "Thanks," I said, sliding onto the stool on your left. "Happy birthday," you answered. "Nice crown." I laughed and slipped it off. "It might look better on you," I said. "Wanna try?" You did, crushing your curls with the paper. "Stunning," I told you. You smiled and put the crown on the bar in front of us. "I almost didn't recognize you," you said. "You did something new to your hair." "Bangs," I told you, pushing them to the side. You stared at me like you did in your kitchen, seeing me from all angles.
"Beautiful with or without bangs."
You slurred your words a little, and I realized that you were even drunker than I was, which made me wonder why you were alone, lit at 7 p.m. on a Thursday night. "How are you?" I asked. "Is everything okay?" You propped your elbow on the bar and leaned your cheek into your hand.
"I don't know," you said. "Stephanie and I broke up again. I hate my job, and the U.S. invaded Iraq. Every time I see you, the world is falling apart."
I didn't know how to respond to that, the information about Stephanie or your assertion that the world was falling apart. So I took another sip of my martini. You kept going.
"Maybe the universe knew I needed to find you tonight. You're like Pegasus."
"I'm a winged horse, like in the Iliad?" I asked you. "A male winged horse?"
"No," you said. "You're definitely female."
I smiled. You continued talking.
But Bellerophon never would have defeated the Chimera without Pegasus. Pegasus made him better, he said. He got to fly above everything, all of the pain, all of the hurt, and he became a great hero. I hadn't understood that myth the same way. I'd read it as one about teamwork, about cooperation and partnership. I'd always liked how Pegasus had to give Bellerophon permission to ride him. But I could tell your interpretation was important to you. Well, thank you for the compliment, I think. Though I might have preferred a comparison to Athena, Hera, even a Gorgon. The corners of your mouth quirked up. Not a Gorgon. No snakes on your head. I touched my hair. You haven't seen how I look first thing in the morning, I said. You looked at me like you wanted to. Did I ever tell you I was sorry, you asked, for what happened with us? I'm not sorry I kissed you, I mean, but... You shrugged. I'm sorry about what happened after. I was trying to do the right thing with Stephanie. Life is... complicated, I finished for you. It's okay. It's forever ago now, and you did apologize. Twice. I still think about you, Lucy, you said, looking into your empty glass of whiskey. I wondered how many you'd had. I think about that fork in the road. What would have happened if we'd taken it? Two roads diverged. Now I would laugh if you called us a road. But then it felt so romantic, you quoting Robert Frost to me. I looked over at Alexis and Julia. They were watching us as they drank their martinis. You okay? Julia mouthed to me. I nodded. She tapped her watch and shrugged. I shrugged back. She nodded. I looked at you, gorgeous, fragile, wanting me. My birthday present from the universe, perhaps. The thing about roads, I said, is sometimes you happen upon them again. Sometimes you get another chance to travel down the same path. God, we were lame. Or maybe just young. So, so young. You looked at me then, right at me, your blue eyes glassy but still magnetic. I'm gonna kiss you, you said, as you tipped toward me. And then you did, and it felt like a birthday wish come true. Will you come to my apartment tonight, Lucy? You asked as you tucked a rogue lock of hair behind my ear. I don't want to go home alone. I saw the sorrow in your eyes, the loneliness. And I wanted to make it better, to be your salve, your bandage, your antidote. I've always wanted to fix things for you. I still do. It's my Achilles heel, or perhaps my pomegranate seed. Like Persephone, it's what keeps drawing me back. I lifted your fingers to my lips and kissed them. Yes, I said. I will. 7. Later we were lying in your bed, our bodies illuminated only by the city lights leaking in around your blinds. You were the outer spoon, your arm wrapped around me, your hand resting on my bare stomach. We were tired, satiated, and still a little drunk. I want to quit my job, you whispered, as if the darkness made it safe to say it out loud. Okay, I whispered back sleepily, you can quit your job. You rubbed your thumb along the underside of my breast. I want to do something meaningful, you said, your breath warm against my neck. Like you talked about. Mm-hmm, I answered half asleep. But I didn't get it then. Get what? I mumbled. It's not only about finding beauty, you said, your words keeping me awake. I want to photograph all of it. Happiness, sadness, joy, destruction. I want to tell stories with my camera. You understand, right, Lucy? Stephanie didn't, but you were there. You know how that changes your view of the world. I rolled over so we were facing each other and gave you a soft kiss. Of course I understand, I whispered before sleep pulled me under. But I didn't really get what you meant or know how far it would take you. That it would bring you here, to this moment. I was drunk and tired and finally in your arms the way I'd imagined so many times. I would have agreed to anything you asked just then. 8. You did quit your job, of course, to take photography classes.
And we kept seeing each other, our physical connection getting even stronger the more time we spent together, finding solace, hope, strength in each other's embraces. We undressed in restaurant bathrooms because we couldn't wait until we were home. We crushed each other against the sides of buildings, bricks digging into shoulders as our lips met. We took picnics to the park, complete with apple juice bottles full of white wine, and then lay together, breathing in the scent of the dirt and the fresh-cut grass and each other. "I want to know more about your dad," I said, a few months after we reconnected, walking eyes open into a fault line, willing to risk the earthquake.
"Not much to tell," you answered, shifting so my head rested on your chest instead of your arm.
Your voice was still light, but I could feel your muscles tense.
"He's an asshole."
"An asshole how?" I asked, turning so I could wrap an arm around your stomach, holding you closer. Sometimes I got this feeling that we'd never be close enough. I wanted to climb inside your skin, inside your mind, so I could know all there was to know about you.
"My dad was unpredictable," you said slowly, as if choosing that word with the utmost care. "Once I was big enough, I protected my mom."
I picked my head up off your chest and looked at you. I wasn't sure what to say, how much I should ask. I wanted to know what your definition was of big enough. 4, 10, 13? "Oh, Gabe," was all I could think of. I'm sorry it wasn't more.
"He and my mom met at art school. She said he was a beautiful sculptor, but I never saw any of his work."
You swallowed hard.
"He smashed it all. Every single piece, right after I was born. He wanted to design monuments, huge installations, but no one was commissioning anything from him. No one was buying his art."
You turned to look at me.
"I know it must have been hard for him. I can't imagine."
Then you shook your head.
"He gave up,"
you said.
"He tried to run a gallery, but he wasn't much of a businessman or a salesman. He was angry all the time. Volatile. I didn't understand what giving up did to him, the power it had. One time he took a knife to my mother's canvas, a painting she'd been working on for months, because he said she needed to spend her time painting sunsets instead. She cried like it was her body he'd stabbed, not just her art. That's when he left."
I slipped my hand into yours and held it tight. "How old were you?"
9,
you said, your voice soft.
"I called the cops."
My childhood had been so different from yours, so idyllically Connecticut suburban. I wasn't sure how to respond. If we were having that conversation now, I would acknowledge the pain, both his and yours. Say that your father clearly had a hard time, that he was fighting demons, and that I'm sorry his demons became yours. Because they did, didn't they? You've lived so much of your life in response to his, trying not to become him, that you ended up battling both his demons and your own. But that day I couldn't process what you were saying quickly enough, and I just wanted to comfort you. After a breath, what I said was, "You did the right thing."
"I know," you answered. Your eyes were hard. "I'll never be like him. I'll never hurt you like that. I'll never act like your dreams are disposable."
"Me neither. I'll never act like your dreams are disposable either, Gabe," I told you, resting my head back on your chest, kissing you through your t-shirt, trying to convey the depth of my admiration and sympathy.
"I know you won't."
You stroked my hair.
"It's one of the many, many things I love about you."
I sat up so I was looking at you again.
"I love you, Luce," you said.
It was the first time you said that to me, the first time any man had. "I love you too," I answered. "I hope you remember that day. It's something I'll never forget."
9. A few weeks after we said I love you for the first time, you and I had my place to ourselves. We decided to celebrate that fact by walking around in our underwear. It was sweltering out, the kind of muggy July heat that makes me wish I could spend the whole day submerged in a swimming pool. And even though the air conditioner was on full blast, the apartment was still warm. It was so big that we probably needed more than one. "Kate's grandparents were real estate geniuses,"
you said as we scrambled eggs half-naked.
When did they buy this place?
No idea, I said, sticking some English muffins in the toaster. Before her dad was born, so 1940s?
You whistled.
I know we didn't stay there often, but I bet you remember that apartment. It was hard to forget. The two huge bedrooms and bathrooms, that breakfast nook we used as a library, and the ceilings that were about 12 feet high. I didn't appreciate those details then, but I did appreciate the apartment. Kate was in law school and her dad had said it was cheaper for her to live there than for him to pay for housing down by NYU. It worked well for me, too. We visited Kate's grandma here when we were in middle school, I told you, as we sat on the couch with our breakfast plates on our bare knees. She was a docent at the Met until she got sick. She'd studied art history at Smith, back before most women even thought about college. I wish I'd met her, you said after a sip of coffee.
You would have loved her.
We chewed quietly, our thighs against each other as we ate, my shoulder grazing your arm. It was impossible for us to be in a room together without touching.
When does Kate come back? You asked after you'd finished swallowing.
I shrugged. She'd met Tom about a month before, and that night was maybe the second time she'd stayed at his place.
We should probably get dressed soon.
I felt your eyes on my breasts. You put your plate down, done with breakfast.
You have no idea what you do to me, Lucy, you said, as you watched me rest my fork on my plate. All morning, you without any clothes on. It's like being dropped into one of my fantasies.
Your hand strayed to your lap, and then you were touching yourself slowly through cotton. I'd never watched you touch yourself, never seen what you did when you were alone. I couldn't stop looking.
Now you said, tugging yourself free of your boxers.
I put my plate down and reached for you, already turned on.
You shook your head and smiled. That's not what I meant.
I raised my eyebrows, and then I understood what you wanted. I slid my fingers down my stomach. You'd never watched me touch myself either. But the idea of it thrilled me. I closed my eyes thinking about you looking at me, thinking about sharing this personal moment with you, and I felt my body shudder.
Lucy, you whispered.
My eyes fluttered open and I saw you stroking yourself faster. It felt more intimate than sex, the two of us performing this act for each other, an act that was usually private. The lines that separated you and me were blurring even more into an us. While I kept touching myself, you leaned against the couch, taking your boxers off completely, your eyes on me the whole time. Our hands sped up. So did our breathing. You bit your lip. Then I watched your grip tighten. I watched your muscles clench. I watched you come.
Oh, God, you said. Oh, Lucy.
I moved my fingers more insistently to join you, but you clasped your hand around my wrist.
May I? You asked.
I shivered at the sound of your voice. Then I nodded and you shifted so I could lie down along the length of the couch, so you could slide off my underwear. You moved closer and the anticipation made me squirm. As you slipped your fingers inside me, you said,
I have a secret.
Oh, yeah? I asked, arching to meet your hand.
Oh, yeah,
you said, stretching out next to me, your mouth against mine.
Whenever I touch myself, I think about you.
A shudder rippled through my body. Me too, I whispered between breaths. I came 30 seconds later. 10. In those first 6 months, I was always learning new things about you. Things I found sexy, surprising, endearing. Like that day I came over to your place after work, and you were sitting cross-legged on the floor, piles of paper squares around you, each the size of a small post-it note. I dropped my bag on the kitchen table and shut the door behind me.
What's going on? I asked. It's my mom's birthday in 2 weeks. September 19th, you told me,
looking up from your paper sorting. Since I can't fly home for it this year, I wanted to come up with something meaningful to send her.
So you're making a paper mosaic? I asked, walking closer.
In a sense, you said. They're all pictures of my mom and me. You lifted up the squares of paper to show me. I looked closer and saw you and your mom at your high school graduation. The two of you in shorts, your feet dangling in a pool. you giving her bunny ears on your front porch.
Wow, I said.
I spent most of the day printing them, you told me. And now I'm organizing them by color. I want to make it look like a kaleidoscope.
I sat down on the floor next to you, and you gave me a quick kiss.
Why a kaleidoscope? I asked, picking up a picture of you and your mom back to back, you a smidge taller. Your hair was the same curly blonde. It was hard to tell where she ended and you began.
I was 14, you said, looking at the picture over my shoulder.
You are cute, I said. My 14-year-old self would have had a crush on your 14-year-old self.
You smiled and squeezed my leg. Without even seeing a picture of you at 14, I'll go out on a limb and say the same would be true in reverse.
Now it was my turn to smile. I put the photo down. But why a kaleidoscope? I asked again.
You rubbed a hand across your forehead, pushing your curls out of your eyes. I never told anyone this story before, you said quietly.
I picked up a couple more pictures. You and your mom blowing out candles on her birthday cake. Your mom holding your hand as the two of you stood in front of a Mexican restaurant.
You don't have to tell me, I said, wondering if your dad had taken the pictures of the two of you from before you were 9, and who had taken them afterward.
I know, you said, but I want to.
You moved so we were facing each other, knee to knee. The year after my parents split, money was really tight. I would come home from school to find my mom crying more often than painting. That year, I was pretty sure if we did anything for my birthday at all, it would suck. I told her I didn't want to party with my friends. I didn't want her to worry about paying for it. I was struck again by how different our childhoods were. There wasn't a time I ever worried that my parents wouldn't be able to pay for a birthday party.
But my mom, you said, I had this kaleidoscope that I loved. I would look through it for hours, turning and turning the disc at the end, watching the shapes shift and change, focusing on that instead of how sad my mom was, how sad I was that I couldn't make her happier, how mad I was at my dad.
You couldn't look at me while you were talking. All your focus was on getting the words out. I rested my hand on your knee and squeezed. You gave me a brief smile.
And?
I asked.
You took a breath. She turned the whole house into a kaleidoscope, you said. It was incredible. She hung pieces of colored glass from the ceiling and turned a fan on low so they'd twirl. It was stunning.
I tried to imagine it, a house transformed into a kaleidoscope.
My mom and I lay there on the floor staring up at the colored glass. Even though I thought of myself as a big kid since I just turned 10, since I was taking care of my mom as best I could, I started to cry. She asked what was wrong, and I told her that I didn't know why I was crying, that I was happy. She said,
"It's the art, Angel."
And I think in some sense she was right. It was the art. But in another sense, I don't know.
"What don't you know?" I asked, unconsciously rubbing circles on your knee with my thumb.
I wonder now if it was relief. If I was crying because my mom was acting more like my mom again. She was taking care of me. And even though she was in this dark and broken place, she was still able to create beauty. I wonder if that art proved to me that she was going to be okay, that we were going to be okay.
You put your hand on my knee now.
She was strong, I said. She loved you.
You smiled as if you were feeling her love right there in that room, and then you kept talking.
My mom and I lay there, both of us crying, and I couldn't help thinking about my dad. How if he were there, we wouldn't have done this. Living with him, I told you, it was unpredictable. It was like I imagined it must have been in London during World War II, knowing the air raid sirens would go off and bombs would fall at some point, but never having any idea where or when they would hit. I whispered to my mom then, "We're better off without him." And she said, "I know." I was only 10, but I felt like a grown-up when I said that.
There were tears in my eyes as you finished talking. I was imagining your 10-year-old self on the floor with your mom, thinking about your dad, feeling like an adult, feeling loved, surrounded by art that she created just for you.
"So I want to make her something special for her birthday since I won't be there," he said. "Something meaningful. Something that shows her how much I love her, how much I'll always love her, no matter how far away I am. And this mosaic, the idea popped into my head this morning."
My eyes flickered over the tiny photographs.
"I think it's perfect," I said.
The apartment felt charged with emotion, from everything you told me, from the fact that you shared it, that fragile part of you. I leaned in to give you a hug, but it turned into a kiss. Our lips met briefly, then more insistently. Thank you for telling me, I said softly. You kissed me again. Thank you for being someone I wanted to tell. Later that night, you started gluing the kaleidoscope together. You seemed so happy in that moment, so content, that I put down my computer and quietly picked up your camera. It's the only photograph I ever took of you. I wonder if you still have it. 11. As comfortable as we were together alone, as intimate as our relationship was, it took a while to get used to going to parties with you. I always felt like I was floating in your wake. It was like you had this magical spell that brought people's attention to you, your face, your words, your stories. Our world of two became your world of one, and then expanded into a world of many in which I wasn't as important as I'd been before. Mid-story, I'd slip away to get a drink or to go find someone else to talk to. Once in a while, I'd cast my eyes in your direction and see you holding court. You'd find me, eventually, when you were drunk and drained. It was like working that charm sapped all your energy. When we were alone together, you could recharge, and then we'd go out and mingle again. In those moments, it made me feel special that you chose me to recharge with. The epitome of Gabe at a party was that night we went to Gideon's birthday at his parents' apartment on Park Avenue. There was that formal library that we weren't supposed to enter, at least not with drinks in our hands. With our balance impaired by a few too many cocktails, Gideon was worried we'd ruin the first edition Hemingway or the signed Nabokov. And seeing the way people were drinking at the party, he probably wasn't wrong to worry. I'd been talking to Gideon's girlfriend, who worked in advertising. I was interested in hearing about the life I'd once contemplated living. We were comparing methods of storytelling when I turned my head sideways to check for you. And you were gone. I assumed you went to the bathroom or to refill your drink, but then it was 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and you hadn't come back. I'm so sorry, I said to her, when I became too distracted to participate in the conversation any longer. But I seem to have lost my boyfriend. She laughed. I imagine that happens often with him. I didn't laugh with her. Why do you say that? I asked. She shrugged apologetically, realizing she'd said the wrong thing. Oh, I just meant that he's charming. I imagine people like talking to him. Well, I can't speak for everyone, but I sure do, I said. She was right, though. That was your magic. Everyone loved talking to you. You made them feel heard, cared about, listened to. I always figured that was part of why people who wouldn't allow anyone else to take their photograph often agreed to let you do it. You made them feel seen. You made me feel seen. I wandered through the apartment and couldn't find you anywhere. Until I heard your voice coming from the forbidden library. I poked my head in and you were talking to a woman I didn't know. She had red hair that curled like a lion's mane around a delicate cat-like face. My stomach dropped when I saw you leaning against the bookcase, absorbed in whatever she'd been telling you. There you are, I said. You looked up and there was no guilt on your face, just a smile, as if you were expecting me to join but I was late to the appointment. Me, you said. There you are. Rachel was just telling me about the restaurant she hostess is at. She said she can get us a deal. A discount on the prefix menu. I looked over at Rachel, who was clearly less happy to see me than you were. She'd fallen under your spell. That's really nice of you, I said. Rachel smiled a tight little smile. Nice to meet you, Gabe, she told you. Then she lifted up her empty glass. Going to head back to the bar for a refill, but you have my number. For the reservations. Thanks again, he said to her, your smile beaming her way now instead of mine. Then she walked out of the room. I didn't quite know what to say. I hadn't caught you doing anything other than talking to someone about restaurant discounts. But why were you in the library with her? Why hadn't you come to find me? What you doing in here? I asked, keeping my voice light. You crossed the room and pushed the door shut, a grin on your face. Scouting for some place we could do this, you said. Then you grabbed my wrists and held them above my head as you leaned me into the bookcase and kissed me hard. I'm going to make love to you in this library, you told me, while the whole party is going on outside. And I'm not going to lock the door. But, I said, you kissed me again and my protest stopped. I didn't care about finding you in the library with Rachel anymore. All I cared about was your fingers tugging down the waistband of my tights and the sound of you unzipping your fly. I wouldn't put up with that now, and I shouldn't have put up with it then, you placating me with a kiss, erasing my concerns with an orgasm. I should have made you explain yourself. I should have called you out for flirting with someone else, for not coming to find me. But you were like a drug. When I was high on you, nothing else mattered. Shh, you said, as you lifted up my skirt. I didn't even realize I was making any noise. I bit my lips so hard to keep from calling out as I came that when I kissed you afterward, there was a smear of blood on both of our mouths. I loved you so much, and didn't doubt your love for me, but I'd never forgotten about Stephanie, and I think deep down I was worried that it could happen again, that you'd leave me for someone like her, or like Rachel, or a million other women you ran into on the subway or at Starbucks or in the grocery store. The seesaw of our relationship wasn't always balanced. Usually we were even. Usually we were equal. But once in a while, I'd find myself down at the bottom, trying to spring back up, afraid that you'd jump off to be with someone else and I'd be stuck without any chance of reaching equilibrium. But even if I'd said something in that library, I don't think it would have changed anything. Because it wasn't another woman that I should have been worrying about. 12. Those doubts didn't appear often, though. There was so much more to us, so much more about us that fit together perfectly. We both cared about each other's passions, about the careers we dreamed we'd have one day. You watched every single episode of It Takes a Galaxy, the TV show I was working on then, and gave me your thoughts on how the different aliens modeled social situations for kids. You seemed so into it that I started asking what you thought even before the shows went into production. I didn't have any real power then, not yet. But I got to review scripts and storyboards and pass along feedback to my boss. I took that responsibility more seriously than I probably needed to. When I brought scripts home, you'd act them out with me so we could talk through them together. You always asked to play Galacto, the little green guy who looks kind of like a frog. My favorite was Electra, the dark purple one with sparkly antennae. It seems fitting somehow that reading an It Takes a Galaxy script is what helped you tell me your dreams. The show is supposed to help children communicate their feelings, but I guess it works on adults, too. I remember the episode we were working on when our conversation happened. It was the beginning of November, and we were about a third of the way through the newest season. Galacto sits in his front yard with his head in his hands. Electra enters. Electra. What's wrong, Galacto? You look sad. Galacto. My dad wants me to play on the Starball team, but I hate Starball. Electra. Does he know that? Galacto. I'm afraid to tell him. I'm afraid he won't want to be my dad anymore if I don't like Starball as much as he does. Electra. My dad likes Starball, but I don't, so we do other things together. Maybe you could make a list of the things you and your dad both like. Galacto. Do you think that would work? And then I wouldn't have to play Starball anymore? Electra. I think it's worth a try. Galacto. Me too. Do you think maybe Electra should like Starball and her dad shouldn't? I asked when we finished reading. You know, flip the gender stereotype a little. Maybe I should suggest that. I think that's a great idea, you said, looking at me a beat longer than usual. In that moment, it felt like you loved not only my idea, but every aspect of who I was. I made some notes on my script, then reread the scene silently. Do you think Electra should name some things that she and her dad like doing together? Would that strengthen the dialogue? You didn't respond to my question this time, so I turned to look at you. Your focus was on a pigeon cooing on your fire escape. I'm afraid I'll turn into him, you said. I put the script down. Turn into who? Absurdly, my first thought was the pigeon. You rubbed your hand against the stubble on your chin. My dad. That I'll have all these dreams and I'll never achieve them. That it'll make me angry and bruised and broken inside, and I'll hurt everyone around me. What dreams do you have? I asked. New dreams? Do you know who Steve McCurry is? I shook my head, so you grabbed my laptop off the floor and put in some search terms, then turned the screen to me. I saw a National Geographic cover with a girl on it. She was wearing a headscarf and had stop you in your tracks green eyes. Her expression looked haunted, hunted. This, you said,
is one of his photographs. We were looking at his work today in my photography class, and I